outer layer is hard like a warrior, but inside he is a man of faith. No one told me a man could be like you, I say. His lips quirk.
You mean very handsome?
I blush, hearing him use my words from the first night.
I'm adult,
I say. I cannot understand why the Raja claimed me. Devon suddenly goes expressionless.
I trust the Raja has his reasons. It isn't our place to question his majesty.
He stands and bows with wooden joints.
Morning will come quickly. Good night, Viraji.
I frown, seeking Devon's face for what I did to merit his dismissal. Finding only a hardened shell, I leave him alone with the stars. 8. Natasha and I endure the next 5 days of incessant rainfall boxed inside the carriage. Our guards have grown quiet, the drizzle dampening their moods. Soon after we break camp on the 6th morning of stormy skies, the carriage jolts to a halt. Manas opens the door and asks us to step out. A rock has torn away from the sodden hillside and sideswiped the carriage. Natasha and I enter the rain and watch the soldiers repair broken wheel spokes. My face warms as we wait. I have yet to swallow my daily tonic, and my vials are hidden in my satchel inside the carriage. Once the wheel is repaired, Devon orders his men to prepare for departure. We have not spoken since he reverted to formalities days ago. He sends Manas to deliver our meals, and with the heavy rain showers, there has been no nightly bonfire to sketch near. Devon helps Natasha into the carriage and then offers me his hand. I clasp his fingers and search his face for any sign that he is pleased to see me. He stares politely back, his thoughts hidden behind propriety. A deafening boom thunders overhead. Devon's chin jerks up. The firmament releases another tremulous roar, and I cover my ears. A thunderhead materializes on the horizon. Thick black clouds tunnel toward us, seeping across the sky and blotting out the murky light. I have never seen weather appear out of nowhere. Clouds always flow from somewhere. But these are suddenly here. Bell and Ahan spread out to corral the horses that scattered during the thunderclap. Devon directs me toward the carriage door.
Get in!
I step onto the footrail, but my attention is detained by 4 black-cloaked figures appearing on horseback above us on the rise. They look like men, but there is an ominous spirit about them, as if the demon core has escaped from the void. Devon and his men swing onto their mounts. Jivan, our coachman, hurtles into the forward seat. Ground-trembling thunder booms overhead, rattling straight through me. The light rain intensifies to a shocking downpour. My sari is drenched in seconds. The cloaked riders race down the incline. I shield my eyes and watch their galloping horses tear down the sopping hillside. A tumble of land and rocks unlooses behind them, but does not overtake their horses. Coldness entrenches my core. The landslide is following them. Devon hollers from his saddle.
Kalinda, go!
I break from my daze and vault inside. No sooner do I shut the door than Jivan cracks his whip at the horse team. I am thrust backward into the seat. Natasha braces against the bench.
What's happening?
I don't know. Another rumble of thunder shudders around us. Who are our attackers? What are they? I do not understand how, but they brought upon the unnatural storm and held a landslide at bay. We charge over the bumpy road. Natasha and I fly to the ceiling like feathers in a puff of wind, and then hit the floor like bricks. Jivan shouts for the horses to go faster. We stay down. I lift my head when I hear roaring hooves behind us. We are being followed. I open my satchel to retrieve my slingshot, and the tonic vials spill out across the floor. My temperature creeps up, escalating with my fear. A wave of warmth ripples from my veins. I load the slingshot with a firing stone. Natasha stands ready with her dagger. Her fierce stance reminds me of the water goddess. We throw open the side door. Several of my tonic vials fall out, bursting into twinkling showers. Rain pelts my face. We are alongside a cliff. I look down and wooziness spirals through me. A riderless horse gallops to our rear. No one else pursues us. I lean out over the drop and look for the missing rider. At the front of the carriage, Jivan wrestles with a black-cloaked figure. The reins lie slack at their feet. I struggle to steady my balance and aim for the assailant, but the carriage swerves erratically. I drop my attack and grip the door sill.
Here!
Natasha grasps a handful of my sari. She holds my weight, and I suspend myself out the door over the cliff. My head spins from the perilous drop. Arming my slingshot, I look up. The attacker grabs Jivan's throat, and Jivan's face leeches of color. His eyes shrivel in their sockets, his nose and lips wither, his skin sags from his bones. I gape in rapt horror as Jivan crumbles into a mound of ash, and the wind and rain sweep away his remains. Our cloaked assailant picks up the reins to control the horse team.
"Bring me in," I say.
Natasha holds me inside, both of us crushing glass vials beneath our feet. I shut the door, pressing a hand to my heaving stomach.
"What is it?" she says.
"Our coachman is dead. Abuta is driving the carriage." That has to be who is attacking us. I recall the sisters' stories. Buddhas can make fire with their hands. Others can conjure winds and storms or call upon the land.
Natasha's eyes broaden. "We have to get out of here. We're wedged between the cliff and a wall. We have nowhere to go."
The horses slow. I rearm my slingshot and Natasha raises her dagger. We will have to fight our way out. I quash my panic and focus on her frightened yet determined face. Our carriage halts at the same time the rain ceases to drive against the roof. The Buddha disembarks from the coachman's seat, rocking the carriage. Footsteps ring out as he comes around the side, but I barely hear them over my thundering pulse. He stops at the door. Natasha points her blade there, clutching the hilt so hard that her knuckles turn white. I wrench back on my slingshot. A sizzling noise starts, and the door glows, turning to embers. I shrink against one wall, Natasha against the other. The wood disintegrates in a cloud of smoke. I blink my stinging eyes, and Natasha coughs. The haze clears, revealing the cloaked Buddha. The Buddha is no hideous, gnarled demon, but a man. Startling eyes, the shade of honey, peer out from the shadow of his hood. He skims the broken vials on the floor and narrows his eyes at us. He dismisses me with a succinct once-over and concentrates on Natasha.
"Are you the Viraji?" he says to her.
His silky voice is dangerous. I am sopping wet from the rain while Natasha, with her beautiful looks, fits the role of royalty.
"No," Natasha points at me. "She is."
The Buddha turns his attention to me and Natasha jabs at him. His hand whips out and seizes the blade of her dagger. I expect the red of blood, but the metal in his palms turns another red. Fire. He heats the blade to malleability and bends the hot steel, angling it sharply to the floor. He lays his hand over Natasha's on the hilt. I do not know what power he pulses to her through his touch, but her eyes roll back into her head and she flops to the floor unconscious. The Buddha tosses the warped dagger out the door and picks up one of my intact tonic vials.
"Where did you get this?"
I aim my slingshot at his right eye.
"Leave or I will shoot you blind."
"Answer my question and I may spare your life."
He opens the vial and sniffs. His whole body recoils.
"Is this yours?"
"Yes."
He flings the vial out the door. It shatters and I jolt, but I do not release my firing stone. His golden eyes slim to slits.
"Who are you?"
he says. I tip up my chin and try to sound imperial.
"The Viraji! Who are you? What do you want?"
"You are the final Viraji."
He steps closer so that I can see his shadowed head. He has dark hair with brassy streaks and sharp cheekbones. He is younger than I supposed for his abilities. About my age. I memorize his features, and he does mine.
You're the Viraji.
The Buddha throws back his head and laughs. I admit that I am not much to look at, even when I am dry, but his mocking goes too far. I release the slingshot. The Buddha lowers his head at the snap, and my mark goes high, hitting him in the forehead. A gash opens. But before blood swells in the cut, he seizes my throat with both hands.
You have fire in your blood. It would be a terrible waste to kill you.
His skin buzzes with heat, adding to my rising fever. I saw what you did to the coachman, I say. You're a demon.
You call me a demon when it's you who has been chosen to wed one.
He throttles me, sealing off my lungs. My skin flares. I claw at his wrists for freedom and kick him in the shin, but he does not relent.
I admire your spirit,
he says.
Remember that I spared your life when we meet again.
He releases me with a shove. I stumble back and drop to all fours. Gasping, I look up at the empty doorway and hear the beat of retreating hooves. I crawl to Natasha's side. Her chest rises and falls with each shallow breath. Where there was once a door is now a singed gap in the carriage wall. Tonic and shards of glass are scattered around us. I follow the glittery path of destruction to charred spots on the floorboards. My mind replays the attack. Once. Twice. Dismay lashes at my cringing heart. I cannot deny what I see. The Buddha did not touch that area on the floor. I placed my hands there when I fell. Those are not his burn marks. They are mine. 9. I extend my hands away from my body, away from everything. My fingertips radiate heat, as if an oil lamp has replaced my thin flesh. I cannot breathe fast enough to slow my whirling head. Of all the fevers I have had before, I have never had one like this. I flap my hands to cool them off and wrap one against the bench seat. The velvet melts, curling into a scorched hole. I go rigid, fearful of touching anything else and burning the carriage down. How am I doing this? How do I make it stop? Black spots discolor my vision. I shut my eyes and the lights behind my lids blaze. Weakness drills down to my bones. I sway toward a feverish faint, dizziness spreading. I have to stop my fever from rising. The last few tonic vials lie on the floor. I uncork one, handling it as little as possible, and down a revolting sip. That should be enough to extinguish my fever, yet I draw another mouthful to speed up my reaction time to the treatment. Pounding hooves ring out in the distance. My darkened vision gradually clears, and the fires behind my eyelids dim to their usual mellow lights. I test the heat of my fingers by touching the wall. No singeing or smoke. I bow my head. Good gods, what was that? I shove my last three vials into my satchel and arm myself. Slingshot drawn, I defend the burned doorway. My hands quiver. Thundering hooves make the carriage shudder, and then the captain appears on horseback. I lower the slingshot and slouch against the wall. Devin first assesses me for injuries, and then Natasha.
Is she dead?
Unconscious.
Where's the Buddha?
He killed Jivan and ran off when he heard you coming. Devin's eyes pang with hurt when he hears of his fallen comrade. And then, still in his saddle, he evaluates the inside of the carriage. Blood wets the shoulder of his jacket.
And the shattered glass?
He says. Healer Baka's warning to guard my condition slows my reply. The Buddha dropped some vials and they broke. Devin watches me, his gaze doubtful. Two more riders gallop into view, Manas and Yatin. Where are the others? I say. Devin's face sets in a hard mask.
Swept away by the landslide.
Sorrow lances through me. Bell and Ihan are not coming. Devin turns to Yatin.
Natasha will ride with you. Manas, take care of the carriage, quickly. They could return.
Manas swings down off his horse and lifts his khanda. We must stay and fight.
We must think of the Viraji's safety, says Devon.
Manas glares, his face a mottled red.
But, Captain... Release the horses, that is an order.
Spittle builds at the corner of Manas's mouth. He rubs it dry with a hard shove of his forearm and tromps to the carriage. Devon extends his hand to me.
We have to go.
I swing my satchel over my shoulder and accept his hand. His firm grip lifts me into the saddle in front of him. The hem of my petticoat rides up to my knees, and my backside presses against his hips. The light scent of sandalwood fills me, and a flush rises up my face. A narrow saddle leaves no room for respectability. Yatin gathers Natesha in his arms. She rouses, awake but drowsy. He helps her onto his horse with him. She sags against Yatin's broad chest, a button-eyed doll in a giant's lap. Manas releases the horse team, slapping the white mares on the rump. They take off uphill. I am sorry to see them go, but since Natesha and I do not ride, it is impractical to bring them along. The carriage is of no use either. Devon gathers the reins and urges our great horse into a run. The forward motion drives me back into his chest. His strength surrounds me, and I give my weight over to him. He lowers his arms so that they hug my hips, and our bodies meld with the rhythm of the horse. We avoid the trail, traversing rocky ground through thick trees. I scan the misty woodland, the tale of the first Buddhas on my mind. 300 years ago, the demon Kur bestowed upon 4 mortals his most potent powers, the elements that make up our world. Half human and half demon, these Buddhas were formidable, but not immortal. They passed their powers on to their offspring to wield as weapons against mankind. Burning is the worst Buddha power I know of, though the other 3 are heinous too. We ride out the gloomy day without seeing our attackers. I assume that nightfall will compel us to stop, but Devon pauses only long enough to light torches. We press on through the darkness, pushing the horses and the bounds of our endurance. Devon's arms cage me in. I incline my head against his shoulder to rest, but whenever I close my eyes, I see Jivan disintegrate to dust. Sunup births a periwinkle sky without a single cloud. Devon maintains our relentless pace, stretching my tired legs into brittle ropes. I sneak a sip of my tonic when we stop briefly to water the horses, and we continue on. The horses' strides eat up the hours, and daylight dwindles into dusky, bruised heavens. I am about to keel over when the trees break to a rolling highland dotted with fleecy sheep. The Alpanaz's snowy razor peaks are so far off that they could be a dream from my past life. Devon dismounts his horse to speak to an elderly shepherd tending his flock. They both glance at me. I shift in the saddle, wondering what is being said. They part, and the shepherd plods away on his mule, his staff bobbing along until it vanishes over a grassy incline. Devon helps me down. I prop against the horse, waiting for my shaky legs to adjust to being connected with the ground again. We will rest here a while, he says. Yatin lifts Natesha down from his saddle. For how long? She asks. We will kill the horses if we continue running them this way. I scoff under my breath. Natesha cares not for the horse's well-being, but only for her own comfort.
As long as you are beyond the palace walls, you are in danger,
Devon answers. Natesha squares herself to him.
How far away is Vani?
Not far on horseback, he says.
She huffs, and Devon's tone cools.
Farther on foot.
Her eyes widen to outraged circles.
You wouldn't dare.
I do believe that he would, but I leave them to settle their quarrel. I wander to the pool where the horses drink, and I scoop up water and wash my arms and legs. Our descent has dropped us into warmer, stagnant air, and the dust itches. shadows disturb the glassy pond. The elderly shepherd approaches, with a weathered old woman guiding his mule. Both wear threadbare clothes, and their skin hangs from their bones, as it does when one has gone many moons hungry. This serious-faced couple bows to me.
"My wife and I welcome you, Viraji,"
says the shepherd. I catch Devon watching us from the corner of his eye. He must have told them who I am, that this filthy, smelly creature is their intended queen. The shepherd's wife passes me a basket. "For you, may you win a place in the Raja's home as well as in his heart." I bow in appreciation. The winning Raja Tarek's heart will never be my ambition. The shepherd lays a large cloth bundle at my feet.
"You may rest here as long as you need, Viraji."
His accent is strange. His R's roll an unusually long time.
"May Anu guide you and keep protect you."
He nods farewell at the captain, and then he and his wife lead their mule away. The basket they gave me contains a jar of honey and fresh flatbread. I untie the cloth bundle to find more food, along with jugs of water. At the bottom, they left two sets of women's clothes, fitted tunics, headscarves, and loose trousers. They even gave me a flask of apong, a strong liquor, and a bar of soap. This must be the entirety of their reserve. This is too much to accept from anyone, let alone these poor shepherds. I raise my arm to call them back.
"Don't."
Devon presses a light hand to my lower back.
"You will insult them. Few people this far from Vani meet a future Rani."
I look down at the wares. "You shouldn't have told them who I am."
"I didn't. They saw the Raja ride through days ago and supposed who we were. The gifts were their idea."
I meet Devon's insistent eyes.
"They are honored to serve you,"
he says.
"Honor them by accepting their gift."
"I will. We are in no state to refuse. But their sacrifice will not go unrewarded. I want them to have my carriage. They can salvage what's left of it to keep or trade. The gold leafing must be valuable. Please give them directions for how to find it." Devon is silent so long that I expect him to argue. Then he bows and whispers,
"Yes, Viraji."
"Food!" Natesha hurries over. "Clean clothes!" I wait for her to complain about the coarse cotton garments, but she admires them.
"The shepherd and his wife gave us permission to stay as long as we need,"
says Devon.
"We will take turns bathing in the pool and sleep here tonight."
Natesha snatches up the bar of soap.
"I'm first."
I do not bother arguing. The promise of cleanliness and rest is enough. We dine near a campfire, our clean faces reflecting the shining light. Our meal of bread and honey is cold, simple fare, but no one complains. Yatin returns to camp, and I pass him his portions. Devon sent him away on an assignment earlier. Neither said where he was going, but I assume that it involved the Buddhas. Manas broods, tearing out grass and tossing the soft blades into the fire.
"We should have stayed and faced our attackers."
"We were outnumbered,"
Yatin replies.
"We should have tried. One of them was a Galer."
"What's a Galer?" Natesha asks.
"A Buddha who conjures ill winds," Manas says.
Pain burns deep in his eyes.
"A Galer killed my family. I returned home from fishing and our entire village was gone, smashed to the ground by a wind tunnel."
Out of respect for those who perished, I wait a beat in silence, and then ask, "What else can Buddhas..."
"Not tonight."
Devon gazes into the orange heart of the fire.
"We can discuss our enemies tomorrow. Tonight is for those we mourn."
He is the first to speak of his lost men, though we have all been thinking of them. Sheep bleat peacefully in the darkened greenery. Under the eye of the moon, Yatin tells a story in honor of those we lost. The story is Anki's Path, the water goddess's tale of adventure, and one that I know well. Anki strives to walk a straight and narrow path of obedience to her parents, a quest that leads her through mountains infested with crafty demons and serpentine dragons. Yatin reaches the part where Anki tricks a dragon into his own demise, and I drift off. When I awake, the fire has burned low in the night, and our camp is silent. Devin's jacket hangs over me, still stained with blood. I sit up and see him at the perimeter of camp. He has taken off his tunic, revealing a slash across his shoulder. In one hand, he holds the flask of Apong, and in the other, a threaded needle. I creep to his side and grimace at the deep cut. You should have told me you were injured.
You know now.
My nose scrunches at his spicy breath. You've been drinking.
Only a little. The Apong makes the pain bearable.
I inspect his jagged gash more closely and cluck my tongue. It's infected.
I was cleaning it.
He motions at a dirty cloth beside him. Not with that, you aren't. Stay here. He begins to rise with me, and I scowl. Stay, or I will shout and wake the flock. He chuckles under his breath.
Spoken like a true Rani.
Devin's handsomeness shines when he smiles, but I do not appreciate his joviality. He could fall ill from an infection. I wet my new veil with clean water from a cask and returned to him.
You've ruined your gift,
he says. Better the veil than your arm. I clean his wound and then splash Apong on it. Devin growls between gritted teeth.
Must you?
The spirits will purify it. I re-thread the needle with clean thread. I have watched Healer Baka sew stitches, but I have never done so myself. I doubt that Devin would let me near him if he knew this, so I dig the needle through his torn skin with a staid expression. He flinches, but does not gripe. Silence lengthens between us. We are close, our faces nearly touching. His quiet voice reaches out to me.
Thank you. You have many talents, Viraji. They will serve you well in the palace. The Raja's wives are a cunning, vicious lot, but you will claim your place among them.
I cannot think about the Raja's wives. The way Devin describes them, they must be like Natesha. I look up at him. Do you have wives waiting for you at home? Firelight enhances the severe angle of his jaw and the smoothness of his lips, lifting in a wry smile.
I have no wives, and when I marry, I will have only one. From what I've seen, one woman ordering me about will be plenty.
My face warms. Not all women have my temper, Captain.
Not all women wear it as well as you do, Kalinda.
My heart stammers, and I am suddenly aware of his elbow brushing mine. Do not say anything you will regret. His head lulls back.
I already have.
Then why speak? I ask, annoyed with his wavering. Devin leans forward and rests his forehead against mine.
Because you're beautiful.
You're drunk, I scoff.
Kalinda,
he says softly.
I would not be so foolish as to be drunk while on night watch. I assure you I am here. All of me is with you.
His serious gaze holds me near him. Our expelled breaths intertwine, his flowing into me like an intoxicating current. I want to touch the stubble on his jaw to ease my curiosity about whether it is scratchy or soft. I want things I should not want. Leaning away, I finish sewing his shoulder closed. His gaze strokes up and down my face. We are so close that he must be able to hear my crashing heartbeat. I tie off the thread and sit back. Your arm should heal properly now. I rise to rinse out the bloody veil in the pond, and he reaches for me.
Stay in the firelight where I can see you. The Buddhas are following us.
My senses jump.
Why, what do they want? From us? Revenge.
But I am told it all started with a book.
I kneel beside him. What book?
Devon grips the hilt of his sword and surveys the shadowed hillside.
It is called the Zale, a record of the Buddha people, tracing back to when they originally received their powers. 17 years ago, the Buddhas accused Raja Tarek of stealing the Zale, and they retaliated by attacking a village in the west borderlands. No one was prepared for their powers. The villagers could not stand against them, and the Buddhas, they showed no mercy.
He mashes his lips into a line.
The Zale was not there, so they went to the next village, and the next. They destroyed everything in their path until Raja Tarek sent soldiers to drive them out. Our army outnumbered them, but the Buddhas killed thousands. After a year of bloodshed, we finally overcame them. The Buddhas who survived fled to the Sultanate of Janardhan, or went into hiding.
My jaw drops. I have never heard of this war or of the Zale. If the Buddhas think the Raja has their book, why did they attack us? Devon's gaze tenses.
The Buddha warlord must have heard that the Raja claimed his final Viraji, and saw an opportunity for retaliation.
I see my own confusion in his questioning eyes. So then why did the Buddha let me go? Why did he not kidnap me and use me for ransom or kill me as revenge?
Shadows conceal half of Devon's face.
Yatin found them. They are camped nearby, but they have not made preparations to attack. Do you know why?
Should I? I will not mention that the Buddha said that we would meet again, or that I owe him for sparing my life.
Few people face off with a Buddha and live. Why did the burner let you go, Kalinda? What did he say to you?
The honey-eyed man was a burner. A Buddha who burns people and things, like I did to the carriage floor. My heart bangs against my breastbone. He said nothing. I don't know why he let me go or why he's following me.
Following us? Unless you have reason to believe he's only after you.
I don't know what you want me to say. I shove the thread and needle into the basket, busying myself so that I do not have to look at him. This isn't my war. I want the mountains and the temple. I want peace. Devon lays his hand over mine.
I wanted peace too, but I didn't find it in the Brotherhood. I found it in the army. Sometimes the only solution that produces peace is war.
I pull away. I have never heard anything more absurd. If everyone lived according to the 5 godly virtues, there would be no war.
This isn't paradise, Kalinda. War is real. And peace comes at a cost.
Then why don't I have peace? I have paid more than my share. His gaze softens, but I do not want his pity. Good night, Captain. I cross back to my spot by the campfire and settle down. Devon's words about the burner bury daggers of doubt in my mind, and an image of the scorch marks on the carriage floor blisters my memories. I banish the chilling picture and shuffle closer to the fire. 10. I steal a private moment away from camp at dawn, under the guise of using the latrine. Away from onlookers, I take my tonic dosage. Only 2.5 vials remain. Overall, less than a moon's supply. My reserve is lower than I would like, but I can concoct more with the formula Healer Baka gave me once we reach Vani. We are not far from the palace now. Devon's and my time alone last night was a mistake. I need the favor of the gods while I participate in the tournament proceedings. I do not wish to evoke their wrath or the Raja's by disobeying my impeding marriage ties. I will not see Devon punished because he has gotten too close to me. Devon's gaze locks on me when I return to camp. I pretend not to see him waiting beside his horse, and I walk up to Manas and say, "I would like to ride with you today." Manas glances at Devon,
but the captain
will not mind.
"Yes, Viraji."
Manas mounts his horse. I pull myself up with the stirrup and slide in front of him. His leaner body fits more easily with me in the saddle than Devon's. Manas's arms come around me and take up the reins. I lean back against him and wait for my heart to strike a rebellious beat of attraction. But Manas is not built as finely as Devon. None of the men are.
Viraji?
Devon circles to us on his horse.
You've changed the riding arrangements.
Manas tenses at my back. I thought it best to vary whom I share saddles with. I offer him a smile to ease the sting of our separation.
Fine idea. I was going to suggest the same.
My smile falters. After our closeness last night, his distance from me now is yawning. I should be glad of his indifference. Ignoring him requires less effort when he is reserved Captain Nike. But I like him so much better when he is Devon. I remember his words to me. You're beautiful. All of me is with you.
We will ride to the Bavia Desert today and travel straight across, he says, to avoid the chance of being slowed by dust storms. Tomorrow, we reach Vani.
Devon digs his heels into his mount and races for the road. Yatin lifts Natesha into the saddle with him and they gallop off. She has hardly left his side since the attack. I suspect that she chose the largest soldier as her companion in case the Buddhists attack again. We have not heard or seen them, but Yatin was gone when I woke. Upon his return, I overheard him tell Devon,
"They're close."
Manas and I embark for the road. Devon sets a less punishing pace than yesterday's, but the ride brutalizes my sore legs. Instead of looking over my shoulder for golden eyes, I now look forward, into the distance, each of the horse's strides carrying me closer to the turquoise palace. The Bavia Desert has been abandoned by the gods. A scorched abyss of burnt orange knoll stretches to every horizon. We bake in the blazing sun, our camels plodding up and down an endless sea of sand dunes. Around midday, we leave the foothills and enter the flatlands. We trade our horses for camels at a small outpost, refill our casks, and start across the desert. Manas rides in front of me. My gaze slips to the front of the caravan where Devon leads the way. I cover my mouth and nose with a headscarf to fend off the dust. The sun banks low in the sky, and I allow our camel's steady lope to rock me to sleep. A sudden stop wakes me. I sit up from resting against Manas's back and gather my bearings. Sunrise marks our eastern flank. To the west, illuminated on the crest of a hill, the turquoise palace shimmers like an opal in the distance. The palace consists of a series of ivory buildings patched together by massive golden orbs tapering into points on top. Our camels lumber toward Vani, the far-off hill growing to a solitary mountain. Stacked below the palace, as if holding it up, lies the City of Gems. Clay huts roofed with rust-colored tiles crouch together against the hot desert sun. Splashes of green from the leafy fronds of tall, skinny palm trees break up the dull brown, and smoke tendrils rise in short plumes, sky trails to civilization. We approach a towering wall of clay bricks encircling Vani, and I sip my tonic dosage when no one is paying attention. We reach a hut outside a city gate, and two soldiers greet us. Sand crusts their beards and turbans, and their fists are tight on their khandas. Devon addresses the guards, and they speak in low voices. I gaze up at the turquoise palace and wipe sweat from my brow. Sunlight glares down on me from the gold-domed palace roofs, and my mouth goes dry at their grandeur. Devon turns back to us.
Kalinda and Natesha, please unveil.
We remove our headscarves and the guards study our faces. I wash my expression clean of curiosity. Finally, the guards step back. What was that for? I whisper to Manas.
One of the Ranis ran away with her lover. They are looking for them.
What happens if they catch her?
She will be executed as a traitor,
Manas says matter-of-factly. I rock back in my seat away from his heartlessness. He
He takes my distance to mean something else.
Do not worry, Viraji. The runaway Rani will not affect your rank tournament. The Raja may wed only 100 women in his lifetime. Even if one of his wives dies or leaves, she is still counted as his.
Manas's effort to pacify me leaves a foul tang in my mouth. I stay bent away. The guards open the city gate and wave us along. Our camels lurch forward, and we pass through the city wall. Haggard-looking women, bow-shouldered men, and half-naked children fill the yards, roadways, and rooftops. Though we sit on the camels high above people's heads, the buildings dwarf us. Huts are crammed so closely together that a child can scarcely squeeze between them. The crowded streets stink of unwashed human flesh and animal waste decaying in the hot morning sun. Manas pulls back on the reins to let a woman balancing a basket of grain on her head pass. I have never been anywhere like this. The heat, the bodies, the noise, and the stench tighten my chest into a snarled coil. To level my breathing, I pretend that I am in the Samia Temple Chapel, surrounded by a sea of daughters wearing calming blue saris. Devon rides up to a road dammed with tents and dismounts. Manas helps me down after him. This new swarm of people and tents and animals shatters what is left of my composure. I gasp, trying to inhale enough air to feed my body, but my head spirals like water going down a spout. I shut my eyes. I have come this far. I can make it to the palace. Soft lights shine behind my eyelids. I focus on their serene brightness and ease my breathing one mouthful of air at a time. My chest loosens ever so slowly, and my head clears. On a steady breath, I reopen my eyes.
The camels are too big to pass through the market.
Devon hands the reins of our camels to a peasant boy with a face smudged with dirt.
These are yours. Trade them and give what you earn for them to your parents.
My parents turned me out.
The boy juts his chin.
I'm on my own.
Then trade the camels and go to Brother Shan at the temple. You can trust him. Tell him Captain Naik sent you. He will help you find a place to stay.
Devon bends so that they are eye level and passes the boy a gold coin.
For taking the camels off our hands.
The boy gapes at the coin in his dirty fist.
Go on. Say hello to Brother Shan for me.
The boy collects the reins and guides the camels away. That was good of you, I say softly.
A real kindness would be to go with him. He will be lucky if he isn't robbed of the camels before he sells them, or if the buyer gives him a fair trade.
Why do you think his parents turned him out, I ask, thinking of my own.
Most families are poor and forced to put their children out at a young age. The boys resort to begging and stealing. And the girls?
Devon turns his solemn gaze on me.
You were fortunate to be taken in as a temple ward.
I see. Vani is a place of plenty, with people, huts, and sunshine, but also hardship, poverty, and sadness. My parents having left me with the brethren may have been a blessing. Does the Raja know his people live this way? Devon lowers his voice.
The Raja is aware.
I glance around, confounded. Raja Tarek allows his people to live in squalor. How can he not wish to help them? I frown at my quick judgment. The sisters did not hide the Raja's flaws. He is a strict man with an appetite for women and power. But they also said that he is generous and judicious, a man of faith. What virtue could he gain from his subjects' poverty?
We're going into the market now.
Devon offers me his hand.
It's easy to get lost in there.
I did not think that he noticed my moment of panic earlier, but I suppose he did. I accept his hand, and our fingers entwine. He smiles and gives an encouraging nudge, and we lead the way into the busy market. Yatin and Natesha follow at our backs, with Manas at the last. Awnings hang from the surrounding structures, encroaching on the narrow roadway. I gawk at a man with a monkey on his shoulder and salivate when we pass a plate of fried sweetbread.
Merchants shouted us to purchase their wares. They sell everything from clay pots to spices to animal hides. Devon is unfazed by their heckling, but I stay tethered to his side. A loud boom startles me. What was that? Devon smiles at my jumpiness. Performers. They entertain for coin. I crane my neck and see people assembling in a small courtyard to watch a woman dancing to a drummer's beat. Her movements are strong and purposeful, her theatrical gaze steady and direct. Bells chime around her ankles, jingling with each rhythmic step. She aims her startling stare toward me, and I look away. My gaze snags on someone across the road with honey eyes. I freeze, and the burner grins at me. Devon? I yank his arm. The burner.
Where?
In one movement, he reaches for his sword and pushes me behind his back. I peer around Devon and point to the spot where I saw him. He was there. I search the shifting crowd for his face. He's wearing a dark headscarf and he has golden eyes. Devon's attention jumps to me.
Golden eyes?
He returns his sharpened gaze to the market and whistles. Manas and Yatin immediately come to our side, Natasha with them.
The burner is here. Manas, find him. Yatin and I will get the girls to the palace.
Manas takes off, and we shoulder our way to the other end of the market. There, Devon pays a man more coin than I have ever seen for his two horses. Natasha rides with Yatin. I settle into the saddle in front of Devon. We race uphill, streaking past decrepit buildings and dirty faces. I watch for the burner, but there are too many shadowed doorways where he could be hiding. The scenery briefly opens to stone pavers curving down to a wide, muddy river, jammed with people washing clothes and bathing. We return to the winding and closed streets and climb higher. Near the top of the mountainous city, a great white wall surrounds the palace. Imperial guards spot our approach and open the golden gates. We burst inside, and Devon yanks on the reins, bringing us to a sudden halt. He helps me down and runs his hands over my shoulders.
Are you all right?
I nod, coldness pooling inside me. The burner must have come to collect on our bargain. But what could he want as payment for sparing my life? Coin? Land? Valuables? Whatever he seeks, I have only the clothes on my back. Devon grasps my upper arms.
You're protected here, Kalinda.
I should be grateful to be standing at the threshold of Raja Tarak's palace, but I am too paralyzed by trepidation about what awaits me to thank the gods for my safety. We scale the marble steps to the main entry, Yatin and Natasha following silently. The turquoise palace is a verdant oasis. Everything the lackluster city below is not. Clean, white walls glow in the sun. Sapphire, canary, and ruby draperies billow from lofty balconies. Warm air, thick with the perfume of evaporated morning dew and desert flowers, clings to the breeze. Tall, silver-plated doors adorned with elephant faces, their gold trunks coiled into handles, mark the entrance. An imperial guard opens the door, and I step into the Raja's stronghold. 11. Devon guides us past the grand double stairway to an arched doorway. Two imperial guards in dark uniforms, with khandas slung at their hips, defend its threshold. A thin, copper-hued drapery blocks our view inside. My heart trips into a fall. Raja Tarak could be waiting within. I am not alone in my unease. Yadin shifts on his big feet, and Natasha wrings her skirt. Devon draws the muslin shade.
Kalinda and Natasha, follow me. Yatin, you may go.
Natasha throws her arms around Yatin's brawny waist, stunning me with her openness and affection. Yatin pats her head and says,
I will see you soon, little lotus.
Natasha lets him go, and we enter the receiving hall. Translucent fabrics drape above our heads, lowering the high ceiling and bringing the massive chamber a lavish coziness. A peacock, a bird that I have seen only in books, struts across the carpet, pecking at stray sand fleas. The bird's eye-catching feathers mimic the brilliant array of colorful floor cushions scattered about. Divin kneels before a dais raised three hands above the ground, where a stunning young woman lounges on a gold and jewel-encrusted throne. She invites Natasha and me forward with a flick of her red-painted fingernail. I am suddenly aware of every granule of sand in my hair and every speck of dust on my clothes. We pass down the silk-laden aisle. A wide-open balcony behind the dais ushers in ample daylight, which warms the smooth marble floor. The brighter lighting adjusts my first opinion of the lady's age. Her curves are taut and sinuous, and her skin has the flawless sheen of a rose petal, but her overall look speaks of the maturity and refinement of a woman 40 years through her life. A girl about my age stands beside the lady, propping her elbow against the throne. She is dressed exquisitely. Her ebony hair is tied in a braid ornamented with calla lilies.
"Will you introduce us, Captain?"
says the seated woman, her voice a smoky purr. Devon bows.
"Kindred Lakia and Lady Anjali, this is the Raja's final viraji and his newest courtesan."
The kindred, the Raja's number one wife, is the older woman. Lakia is the deadliest Rani in history. The girl, Anjali, must be one of the Raja's courtesans. Anjali sizes up Natasha.
"So you're the viraji Tarek traveled far and wide to find."
"You have it wrong,"
Lakia says, pointing a red fingernail at me.
"She was claimed to be Rani."
Anjali glances between Natasha and me.
"Are you certain?"
"I'm certain it isn't your place to correct me, Anjali."
Lakia's voice wields an edge.
"You may be one of my husband's favored courtesans, but you are still only a courtesan. Now leave me and the viraji alone, all of you."
Servants so quiet and hidden that I had not seen them flee from the recesses of the hall. Anjali steps off the platform and struts to Natasha.
"I will show you to the courtesan's wing," she says. "It isn't as grand as the wives' wing, but it's less dull."
She tries to loop her arm through Natasha's, but Natasha wrenches away.
"You won't be the Raja's favored courtesan for long," says Natasha.
Anjali smirks and forces her arm through Natasha's, securing the crook of her elbow.
"You will do just fine here."
She leads a stony Natasha to the door, and Devon follows.
"Captain,"
Lakia calls,
"please escort them to their wing and return here."
Devon hesitates and then ducks out. I brace myself against the kindred's hard, glittering gaze and pray that he returns quickly. Lakia sweeps her gold-embroidered silk sari behind her and steps off the pedestal.
"What's your name?"
"Kalinda." The kohl lining her eyes makes them look tapered.
"No surname?"
"I'm certain I have one, but I never met my parents." Lakia fingers my sandy headscarf and then brushes off her hands.
"Remove it."
I do, letting my hair hang loose. She circles me, and the peacock struts behind me.
"I am the kindred. Do you know what that means?"
"You're a Rani."
"I'm the Rani."
She stops before me. I can see over her head. I am that much taller than she is. Her bare shoulder has a dark, raised scar, a healed stab wound, and a thin white scar marks her jawline.
"You will call me Lakia. I am kindred to Tarek and our people, but I will never be kindred to you. I'm charged with watching over my husband's other interests. Any punishment you receive will come through me."
Her nose turns upward.
"How old are you?"
18.
"At least you're of age. Tarek has developed a taste for young girls. Anjali was 14 when she came here."
She curls her upper lip in distaste.
"How did you know I was claimed to be His Majesty's wife, and not Natasha?" Lakia grabs a handful of my hair and speaks into my ear. I know my husband. Her breath smells of spearmint and her skin of cinnamon oils. She releases my tresses a few strands at a time so that they swing past my shoulder.
His wives have only one trait in common. Beautiful hair.
She flicks the last of the locks into my face and I flinch. When will I see the Raja? I say. She grips my shoulder, digging in her nails. I withstand her biting grasp, refusing to balk for her amusement. On the back of her hand, I see a single line dyed in henna. A matching line marks her other hand. I do not recognize the symbol.
Proceedings for the rank tournament will begin shortly. You will...
Lakia eases up on my shoulder.
Ah, oh, Captain,
she says, as she sails back to her throne. Devon approaches her dais and kneels. My gaze latches onto him, a steady rock in this torrent of change.
Rise, Lakia says. Tell me about this trouble you had on your journey. We were attacked by Buddhas in the lower Alpanus. They killed three of my men and followed us to the desert. I thought we lost them, but the Viraji spotted one of them, a burner, in the marketplace. My men are searching for him.
Lakia clicks her fingernails together.
Tarak anticipated this, which is why he asks that you reconsider your advancement to the Imperial Guard. The Buddhas will do everything in their power to interfere with the rank tournament and prevent him from crowning his 100th Rani.
You are one of the few soldiers Tarak trusts implicitly. He wishes for you to supervise the Viraji's protection. Reconsider his advancement. They asked Devon to be an Imperial Guard once before. Why did he refuse? Devon bends at the waist.
I'm pleased to serve His Majesty and the Viraji.
He straightens with a glance at me.
I will protect her with my life.
I hold myself still, hiding my swinging emotions. I am pleased to retain Devon as my guard, but I am worried about how I will keep him at a distance that is safe for both of us.
It's settled, then. Viraji, you may explore the palace grounds only while guarded, and you are never to leave the gates. Wives are not permitted in the courtesan's wing, and vice versa. You may not receive or send correspondence with anyone outside the palace walls.
Violations of these rules will result in your swift punishment, which I will decide the severity of. She flourishes her hand, and a serving woman wearing a long black veil appears.
Asha will be your personal attendant.
She will show you to your chamber.
You will dine with the wives for supper tonight.
With another flick of Lakia's hand, we are dismissed. My servant, Asha, escorts Devon and me from the receiving hall. We have hardly exited when we come upon an older officer in a dark blue military uniform. Devon stiffens beside me and slows to a stop. The man's intruding stare combs over me, climbing up and down my body. Asha waits a few paces away with her gaze down.
General Gotham,
says Devon.
You caught up to us. I didn't have a carriage to slow me down,
says the general, his smile glib.
I heard there was excitement in the market.
I know that voice. General Gotham must have been one of the men I overheard in the lower level of the temple. But what does Devon mean that he caught up to us? The general was at Samia after we left? I had assumed that he rode ahead of us with the Raja. Devon stares past the general, his expression controlled.
We saw a Buddha, nothing more. The Viraji is safe here in the palace.
I question how true that is, given that Devon has been asked to stay on as my guard.
No one is safe so long as Buddhas are in the Empire,
says General Gotham.
We should burn the foothills where they hide and be done with them.
Then we would be no better than they are, I say. The general arches his brows in amusement.
I understand why the Raja claimed you, Viraji. He likes fiery women, the gods know why.
He glances around the hall.
Where's the other one? The courtesan.
A pretty thing. I should like to see her.
She's settling into the courtesan's wing, Devon answers. Everything about him is stiff, from his voice to his stance.